Yeah, so I understand that you guys are learning Agadata now, and Agadata is a whole separate type of limud, which in the world of yeshivas, we don't always devote enough time. In fact, a lot of times, people will just skip. You know, you're learning a Masechta, and there's some Agadata blat. Let's just skip the next five blat. And you'll also notice, you can almost tell, Agadata blat tends to be much bigger, like a bigger blat. There's less Tosfos, less Rashi, more words, more Aramaic, and the language itself is sometimes very difficult. So people think Agadata are stories, Agadata are Chas V'Shalom Baba Mises, and people sometimes think the reason it gets skipped is because it's less important. But the truth of the matter is, the opposite is very much the case. The Vilna Gaon, who of course was a person who knew Kol HaTorah, whether it's the revealed and the mystical and everything else, the Vilna Gaon writes that in the Agadata of Chazal are all of the secrets of the Kabbalah and all of the secrets of the Bria. That it is the deepest part of the Torah. And if Agadata is sometimes skipped, it is not because it's so simple that you can just read it like a storybook, so do it on your own. It's the other way around. It is so profound and so deep that even a great, great Talmud Chacham wouldn't necessarily have the keys to it. It's a whole separate Aveda and the like. So this is what Agadata. So the first thing one has to have is one has to have a tremendous, tremendous respect for what is called the Agadic portions. Now again, we have Agadata in the Gemara. We have Agadata in Midrashim, right? Agadata comes from different places. What is Agadata? So Agadata, it's hard to define Agadata. Agadata seems to be almost a definition, a negative definition. Agadata is any teachings of Chazal that are not strictly halacha. It's kind of a negative definition. If it's not a halachic discussion, if it's not a question of what do you do or don't do, it is called Agadata. So therefore, Agadata itself can comprise a huge, huge spectrum. So for example, Agadata might be the explanations of verses, like Megillas Esther, right? You can have explanations of various verses. It might be stories about biblical personalities, or even stories about Tanoim and Amoraim. It may be teachings of Musar and Midos and Derech Eretz. It may be Chazal's teachings on science, astronomy, medicine, and diet. So there's not that much that is a common denominator of all of these things, other than the negative. If it's not a straight halachic discussion, it is called an agadic discussion, and the like. Now, the Rambam writes in the Hakdama to the Parish of Mishnayos and in Sanhedrin that people have two different views about Agadata. And he says both of them are wrong. There is one view of Agadata that basically says Chazal are simply telling stories, they're telling fables, and some of them, again, some Agadata is good because it tells you how to live a good life, but other Agadatas are just Baba Mises, and they're not true. For example, Vashti has a tail, you're going to read. Vashti didn't have a tail, human beings don't grow tails, and the like. So that is school number one, in which they're Mavazeh Divrei Chachamim, and they treat the words of the sages as not having real value, at least in some cases, because they're describing fantastic stories that just never happened. That is view number one. And the Rambam says, these people are sinners. These people are sinners. These people are treating our Chachamim as liars, and they're treating the Chachamim as either superstitious people or just liars. Right? That's not good. But then the Rambam says, there's a group number two, who seem to be very firm and very religious. And they say the following. Every word of Chazal is 100% true. If Vashti had a tail, Vashti had a tail. If Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amos high, which is 20 feet high, then he was 20 feet high. If Og Melech HaBashan, if you remember Moshe Rabbeinu when he killed the giant Og, so it describes in the Gemara that Moshe Rabbeinu took a spear and Moshe Rabbeinu was already, you know, 20 feet high. He was only able to hit Og's foot, sole of his foot, right? So Og was, right? Og was like bigger than Godzilla, right? Gigantic, all the way to the Empire State Building. And they say 100% true. Now that sounds firm, that sounds good. The Rambam says on them, these people are well-meaning people. These people are righteous people. But the Rambam says they're also foolish people. Because here's what the Rambam writes. Now, not everybody, some people will actually say this second position, but what the Rambam writes is, everything Chazal say is true. None of it is false. But sometimes the truth is not meant to be expressed as a literal truth. It is a metaphor or a mashal for a deep spiritual teaching that Chazal sometimes employed hyperbole, exaggeration, vivid imagery to convey a certain truth that we otherwise wouldn't perceive. So the Rambam says, group one says, Agarit is false. Group two said, Agarit is literally true. Rambam writes, both of them are not correct. Agarita is 100% true, but truth is sometimes in the symbolic realm of spiritual teaching, and not necessarily. Now again, what's complicated is the Rambam says, it's a complicated thing, the Rambam says, certain Agarita indeed is literal, and Chazal had a Messiah that it was literal. Certain Agarita is meant to symbolically express spiritual truths, very deep spiritual truths that people might not grasp unless they have a vivid mashal that makes them remember it. Now, problem is, so how do you know which is which and which is which? So here we have something that's very frustrating. The Rambam writes, I promise you that I am going to write a book, a sefer, that will go through the Agaritas of Shas to show you which ones are literal and which ones are not literal, and what the symbolic meaning is. Vavaniseinu harabim, we don't have that sefer. Either the Rambam didn't write it, or it was lost. So we really don't know. We have to struggle one after the other. But I'll tell you what things you can do for this. But this is an immensely important insight in the Rambam. Truth is not always, sometimes it's factual truth, sometimes it is factual truth. I mean, there's no question. If Avraham was thrown into the fiery furnace, which is a medrash, it is really part of our Messiah that he was. That we're not saying it's all mashal. But there are other things that are mashalim, and the like. And this is important, that truth is not always factual issue. There is something called symbolic truth. And in the world of Agadah, symbolic truth is very elusive, very difficult to know, but that is a key to understanding Agadita on a deeper level, on a deeper level. And here, let me give you a mashal that was said much later by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter once explained the way Chazal talk, and he used a mashal from contemporary times. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter lived in the latter half of the 19th century, or that's, he flourished in the latter half of the 19th century. So he gave, and now he lived in Russia, and at the time, Russia was under the Tsar, and the Jews were confined. They were not allowed to live in any city they wanted to. They were limited to a certain area that was called the Pale of Settlement. You may have heard the expression. They were confined to the Pale of Settlement. Now the problem is, because of the anti-Semitism and the sinna of the Tsar, the Pale of Settlement would constantly change. So for example, a Jew might get an order, all Jews have to be out of this city in 2 weeks. You're relocating, it may just be 10 miles to the west. So you literally just had to locate. So imagine if you saw Solange, by the way, that wasn't the worst thing. The absolute worst thing that the Jews went through in Russia were the cantonist system. This is mamish, such an awful, it can rip your heart. This is when Jewish kids were forcibly taken into the Russian army at the age of 8, and they were forced to be in the army for 30 years, away from their parents, away from Yiddishkeit, away from everything. And often the Russians tried to forcibly convert them to Christianity, but if they didn't, what does a person become 30 years away from Yiddishkeit? And many of the cantonists did become Christian. Many of them went crazy. A number of them remained faithful Jews for 30 years like that. They remained faithful Jews. But the tragedy is so great on so many levels, because even those who remained faithful Jews, they tended to be kind of mentally imbalanced. They couldn't when they got out of the army at 38, they weren't old, but 30 years in this army, they couldn't live with regular Jews. They actually had their own villages, and they were still mentally imbalanced. It was a tragedy. But what made the tragedy even worse is that the Russian government required that the Jewish community meet a quota, like every city had to come up with 10 or 20 kids. And rich people would often bribe the community to seize poor kids in their place. And we have a number of stories where Rav Yisrael Salanter interrupted Yom Kippur services, Kol Nidre, and he said, when a poor kid had been kidnapped to take the place of a rich kid, and he said, we're not going to daven further until we ransom this poor child. And he talked about the Chilul Hashem, so the Jews were involved. But okay, but that's just kind of a digression. But Rav Yisrael Salanter said the following. Imagine you're a journalist, and imagine that the Tsar one day issued a decree that says 100,000 Jews have to vacate this territory in a week. If you're a journalist with a powerful expression, how would you write it? So you might write it this way. With a drop of ink, 100,000 people drowned. And that means the drop of ink in the Tsar's pen destroyed the lives of 100,000 people. Now, imagine if 200 years later, you find a newspaper that says a drop of ink from the Tsar's pen drowned 100,000 people. And that's all you read. So you would say, that's ridiculous. What do you mean? How can a drop of ink from a pen drown 100,000 people? Are we talking about a Tsar that's a giant that is 1,000 feet high and his pen is like an ocean? And we would say, this is a lie, this is a shtus, this is a baba maisa. But Rav Yisrael said, if you knew the background, if you knew the history, if you knew the particular event that is being described, you would understand what a powerful way it is to say that the drop of ink of the Tsar's pen destroyed people's lives. Rav Yisrael Salanter writes, and this is really a simple example, that the language of Agadata is exactly that type of language. It's conveying a panemius through a medium of chitonius that is sometimes hyperbolic, exaggerated, vivid, colorful, because that makes you remember and internalize the power of the idea itself. So the idea itself is always emes. The core of the idea is always emes. Chazal conveyed ruchniistic ideas in this type of surah, but the particular mechanism that was employed does not have to be taken literally. Now, again, it's very complicated because sometimes it vaday is literal, and sometimes it's not. We don't always have a clear measure, but at least the point I'm making to you is that if you come across an agadata that you cannot comprehend it as possibly literally true, you should know that you're lav dafka in trouble. That indeed there are different interpretations that acknowledge this idea. Now, so on one hand, here's the interesting, almost contradiction in Agadata. On one hand, Agadata was very, very popular to the common man, the person who was not able to fully understand detailed halachic discussions. Agadata was something that was pleasurable, that was stimulating, that was enjoyable. That is why the Gemara gives us the story about two Tanoim. They came to a city, and one person darshaned in halacha, and he had a very small audience, complicated halacha. Another person darshaned in agadata, and he had a very big audience. And the Baal halacha felt sabrachin, how come I'm not getting an audience? And the Baal agadata gave him an agadic mashal to give him comfort. And he said, two merchants come to the town. One has precious diamonds, and the other sells pots and pans, aluminum pots and pans. Well, who's going to get a bigger crowd? The one with the diamonds, very few people are going to come because nobody can afford the diamonds. But for the cheap pots and pans, you'll get plenty of people. So the Baal Agadata said, you, master of halacha, you have the diamonds. Very few people can understand them. I have the cheap pots and pans. I get a big crowd. So on one hand, Agadata was very popular. We know later, in the time of the Beis Yosef, one of the great rabbis, Maran Rav Levi Ibn Chaviv took all of the Agadic portions out of the Gemara, and he published them separately so people could learn Agada. This is the sefer that is called Ein Yaakov. What is Ein Yaakov? Ein Yaakov is simply the Babylonian Talmud, the Agadas of the Babylonian Talmud, put into a separate sefer with Mefarshim added. I mean, some of the Mefarshim are in the Gemara themselves. Rashi, Tosfos, Marsha, and then the Ein Yaakov also has specialized Mefarshim. But why did he do it? Because there were people who were not capable of following detailed halacha, but Agada they could enjoy, at least on a superficial level. And in fact, this is even an expression in Yiddish. When you have a simple, God-fearing Jew who was not well-learned, he would be called, somewhat affectionately, an Ein Yaakov Yid. He's a Yid that goes to an Ein Yaakov Yid. So on one level, Agadata was popular and accessible. And yet, as the Vilna Gaon said, that is the outer husk. The inner is very profound, very, very deep, symbolic truth. Now, in later generations, this was really the goal of the Maharal of Prague, who lived in the 1500s in Prague, Czechoslovakia. Maharal wrote many, many svarim. But you know that all of the Maharal svarim are kamat devoted to this one theme of trying to uncover the symbolic language of Chazal, to take us away from literalism, to understand the inner meaning of the Agadot. In fact, I'll give you one example about Vashti having a tail. What does it mean Vashti has a tail? So the Maharal says, Chazal are telling you that ignore Chitzenius and look at Panemius. Here's the idea. Vashti was a woman who obviously had no concept of Tznius. She was perfectly happy to parade herself all occasions, b'chol eis v'chol shah. And yet, Chazal point out, when Achashverosh summons her to show off her beauty, all of a sudden, Vashti says, can't go. It's not proper. It's not modest. How could that be? That's not Vashti's nature. So Chazal want to tell you, Vashti not showing up to the party was lamayla min ateva. It had no shaychus to teva. It was a hashkacha pratis. It was a nes. It was part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's decree to begin the series of events that will make Esther the queen and therefore enable her to save Am Yisrael by giving the refuah before the makkah, even before Haman. Because Haman, remember, Haman didn't even get his position until after Vashti was killed. And therefore, how do Chazal express that this is a miracle, this wasn't like a natural thing? By saying, it is just as miraculous as if she had a tail. If Vashti would have sprouted a tail, everybody would have said, it's a miracle. God did something special. Chazal are telling you, in Panemius, for Vashti not to go to a party to show off her beauty is just as miraculous as Vashti having a tail. It's the same thing. I don't see a tail. It's the same thing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu effectively took away her Bechira. It's like Hashem hardened her heart because her decision is not the decision that it's normal for her to make. Right? Things like that. Now, the Maharal makes another point about Agadata, though, which is interesting as well. It's a little different. So one point is symbolic truth. There's another point, though, and that is that even when an Agada is literally true, this is a chiddush on that, even when it's literally true, it is referring to ultimate causation and not proximate causation. I know those are big words. Let me give you an example specifically of what we're talking about. And by the way, all of the Maharal Svarim are expositions of Agadata. All of them. Right? The Maharal has a sefer on Yetzias Mitzrayim called Gevuros Hashem. And he has a sefer on Matan Torah that's called Teferis Yisrael. And he has a sefer on Golos and Geula that's called Netzach Yisrael. Right? And then he has a parish on Pirkei Avos, Derech HaChayim. And then he has a sefer on Midos called Nesivas Olam. All of these things, they may have different topics, but the goal of all of them is to show you Chazal's approach to all of these inyanim through Agadata and Medrash, and to show you the symbolic meaning. In fact, the Maharal even has Chidushei Agada, in which he actually goes through every Agada for some reason, it's so fascinating. Chiddush HaGadol is on every Masechta of Shas except Maseches Brachos, which is quite amazing. Brachos has a lot of Agadata. And the Maral's Chiddush HaGadol begins from Maseches Shabbos. So, I'm not sure what to do about that. I did see that somebody published a Maral on Brachos based on taking what the Maral wrote in all of his other Svarim. And it's still a fat book talking. The Maral had a lot of stuff to say on Agadatas and Brachos, but we don't have the page by page that we have on the other ones. Okay. But all of the Maral Svarim are themes, right? Yetzias Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, Galus Geula, Pirkei Avos. But the Maral did write one Sefer on Agadata itself, just explaining what is Agadata. Not only is it Torah Shabbat Peh general, and that is the Sefer Be'er HaGola. Be'er HaGola is the Maral's actual exposition of the nature of Agadata and Torah Shabbat Peh generally. And he wrote it because in response to people who were attacking the Talmud, attacking the Gemara on a lot of different areas. And this was his great defense of the Gemara and Medrash and Torah Shabbat Peh. And there he makes the following point. In one of the questions that was raised, they accused Chazal of being ignorant of science. And they pointed to an example of a Gemara in Maseches Sukkah, which talks about eclipses. You know, eclipses are when the moon blocks out the sun or whatever it is. And Chazal give reasons for eclipses, that when there's perversion of judgment and when there's dishonesty, different eclipses will happen, etc. And scientists say, remember, you have to remember, the Maral was writing during the Renaissance when science was expanding, Galileo and all of these great astronomers, so Copernicus, Maral even refers to Copernicus. So there was a lot of scientific discovery, and some religion was accused of being superstitious, Christianity and Judaism. And they said, we know why there are eclipses. There are cycles of the earth, cycles of the sun, and eventually they cross each other at the same time, and then you have these eclipses. There are scientific reasons for these things. How can you say that this is a phenomenon that represents a sin? Even if there wouldn't be a sin, there would be this natural cycle of things. And therefore, Chazal were ignorant of science, and that's why they said what they said. And even the people who said this, they were not attacking Chazal. They just said, well, listen, everybody, all the guys were ignorant of science too, so, you know, the rabbis are no worse, but they're no better. So the Maral says the following yisayit. This is an interesting yisayit. He says, you know, Chazal understand that there is a natural reason why things happen. Cycles of the earth, laws of physics, laws of biology. But the question is this. Given the fact that God is the architect of all of those laws, God could have made the laws in a totally different way. You know, if I say, for example, if I drop something, why does it fall down instead of going up? So you're going to tell me, well, the law of gravity. Now, we call that the proximate cause. The immediate cause is a physical law of nature that is part of the Bria. But that doesn't answer a more fundamental question. And that is, God could have made the world with a different law of gravity. God could have made a world in which things that are dropped go up instead of down. Now that's called an ultimate cause. An ultimate cause is, yes, we know there's a scientific cause. But Chazal are not always interested in describing the scientific cause for something. But they are interested in a deeper reality behind the scientific rule as to why did God orchestrate a law that would operate in a certain way. So the Maral says, when Chazal say that eclipses come because of certain sins, it's as if, you know, God knew ahead of time. This is the part of the mystery that God, even though we have free will, God knows the future. That's another famous question, that when all the way back at the beginning of the creation of the universe, God was aware that there would be certain sins committed by man at different times, and therefore the physical structure of the universe was manufactured to inspire within sinful man fear and trepidation over these averos that would bring them to tshuva. It's not ignorance of the science, but it's trying to give an ultimate cause behind the scientific principle. Now, the truth of the matter is, this type of reasoning is not only something Chazal engage in, but this is in the Torah itself. Let's consider the rainbow. Right? The Torah says, and again, the Maral says this himself, the Torah says, after the Mabul Hashem says, that I will show you a rainbow in the sky, and when there's a rainbow, that will be a sign that I will not destroy the world. Ad kidei kach, that the Gemara says, actually, that a rainbow is a little bit of a negative sign, actually, because a rainbow says, God really says, you know, I'd like to destroy the world, but Nebuch, I made a promise, so I'm not going to. It says, when there are great, great tzaddikim in a generation, one of the signs of the greatest of a tzaddik was, there was no visible rainbow in his lifetime, meaning Hashem didn't have a hava mina to want to destroy the world. Okay. Now, the question is, well, once again, you're telling me a rainbow is a divine sign that Hashem doesn't want to destroy the world. It's like it represents an upturned bow. Right? The bow, the part of the bow that shoots the arrow is going up instead of towards us. But here's the thing. We know why there are rainbows. You have water vapor in the air. And when light hits the water drops, it breaks into a prism, right? White light breaks into a prism, breaks into different colors. When it hits a prism, water can be a prism drop. So there's a valid scientific cause for rainbows. They are not mysterious. They could be very beautiful, but they're not mysterious. So how can we ascribe a rainbow to some type of sign of God, given the fact that it's simply white light hitting a prism? The answer once again is, yeah, of course that's what it is. But why did God make light white, and why did God make light split in a prism? Meaning, every single scientific law was negotiable. God could have made the world in any configuration of physical law. Physical laws are not inevitable. Physical laws are inevitable only because they are the world that we have, and the world that we see, and the world that God made. But God could have made the world in countless, infinite other ways. And the answer is, the world was configured in this way to communicate a certain spiritual message. So this is a little different. In other words, there are two different points Maral is making here. One is that Agada is not always, which is really the Rambam's point earlier, Agada is not always literal truth. It is often symbolic truth. The second point is a little different, and that is, Agada is not concerned with immediate causes. It is concerned, proximate causes is a fancier term, it is concerned with ultimate causes. Which means the Agadah about the eclipse is literal, but it's not dealing with the immediate cause of the eclipse, it's dealing with the ultimate configuration of those scientific laws. Right? So those are kind of different approaches you will have with Agadah. One thing that is important, Agadah presupposes a good knowledge of Tanakh, which is a weakness, another weakness that we often have. And sometimes to understand how Chazal are interpreting a verse, you need to know what the Pashut Pshat of the verse is. What is the verse saying? How is the Pasuk translated, let's say, by Rashi or Metsudas David, or even an English translation? And then you need to know what is the Kasha in the Pshat, meaning to say, if Chazal have an interpretation that is different than what the normal translation would be, that is because they saw some question, some anomaly, some difficulty in the verse, which is kind of a sign to them that there's a deeper alternative meaning. So it is important. We often don't do it, but it's actually an important thing to do. In the new Shasas, I don't know if you're using the new Shasas, the Oz Vahadra or whatever it is, they now give you the whole Pasuk, you know, so even without a Tanakh, you can at least see what the Pasuk is, and in the back, they even give you a commentary, right, they have the back of the Pesukim. Those are very good, those are very, very useful things to use, and in Agadah in particular, it's kedai to spend time, because you appreciate Chazal, even in Pashut Pshat, much, much better if you understand what the Pasuk seems to have been saying and what Chazal are saying different in that Pasuk, and then you try to understand why Now, this is not even getting into the deeper meaning. This is even Pashit Pshat in the Agarata. In fact, the Marsha, that's kind of the Marsha's main job. The Marsha, who wrote a commentary on Agarata, often, I mean, he sometimes goes into the deep symbolic meanings, but often the Marsha's job is to tell you Pashit Pshat of the Pasuk, and then what's Shver in the Pasuk, and then how Chazal or Mefarish. That's kind of what you might call the basic structure of Agada. And you'll see that you'll appreciate Agada much, much more if you know where it's coming from. Okay, so that's something to pay attention to, even without getting into the deeper levels. But again, Agada presupposes that we knew Tanakh well. Again, well, sometimes we don't know Tanakh as well as we should, particularly Nevi'im and Kesuvim, but, you know, you can use Agadot as a way of building up your Tanakh at the same time. So, you know, Rabbeinu Tam says, if one says in Avodah Zarah, a person should divide his Torah learning into three sections, a third in Torah Shebichsav, a third in Mishnah, which is really Halacha Psuka, and a third in Gemara. So, L'chara, we should divide our time in three, which we don't so much. So Rabbeinu Tam has a heter that if one learns Talmud Bavli, one learns Gemara, one is Mekayim all three, because in Talmud Bavli we have Torah Shebichsav, and we have Mishnayos, and we have Halacha. And he even says with Derech Drash that the reason it's called Bavli, of course Bavli because it was written in Bavel, but he says Bavli, it's Balul, it's mixed up with all of the components of Torah. So what that means is that even though one should set aside time for Torah Shebichsav, but one can also use the Agadot as a way of augmenting their knowledge of Nach. In fact, it would be a good idea in many cases not only to look up a Pasuk, but even to read maybe a whole paragraph. Reread the Pesukim before and after. Now, in Megillas Esther, that's going to be easy because most of us know the story, etc. But in any Agadot, sometimes it'll be a very unfamiliar Agadot, and you don't even know what the story is that it's talking about. Always be sure that you know the story, and then you can appreciate what Chazal are doing in a much greater way. So be it as it may, we'll stop here. I hope you have much, much hatzlacha. The world of Agadata is a new world, but it's a very, very beautiful world. The Vilna Gaon says that halacha is described as mayim, water, because without water you cannot live. Water is necessary for survival. Without halacha, we are dead. But Agadata is described as wine. Wine is that which gives you simcha, and it brings you closer to Hashem. And in many ways, halacha is the guf of yadus, the guf, the body, how I serve with the body, and Agadata is the neshama of yadus. It tells you, what are you serving Hashem for? What exactly is your goal in serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So we should be zeichet to keep the guf and the neshama together, and that way we should accomplish much, much hatzlacha. Okay, so, yeah.